To the brightest audience in the country, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church. The most important update today is that this evening is the last chance to catch in theaters nationwide as a Fathom event the sequel to Patterns of Evidence, The Moses Controversy. What a fabulous film. In fact, I got an email from the publicist for Tim Mahoney, who produced the film, and her name is Jane, and she said, Bob, what a wonderful comment from listeners to Bob and Yurt Live from Indiana. So let me read this to you. My husband Doug and I attended on Saturday at the Regal Theater in Fort Wayne, Indiana, the film Patterns of Evidence, The Moses Controversy. It was exceptional. The film moved us both to tears. I am so grateful to Tim Mahoney and his crisis of faith. What a demonstration of God's faithfulness to the hearts who search him out and test to see that the Lord is good. Blessings, Melody L. So what an encouragement. We have friends of Bob and Yurt Live and Real Science Radio all over the country who are going to see the film. It's showing on 900 screens. And while I was in Indiana this weekend, checking in on my email, listeners to this show here in Denver said, by the way, Bob, we checked two theaters and they were sold out. So we finally got tickets at a third theater. So it's a real good idea to go online to get your tickets. And we make that super easy right now, kgov.com. kgov.com, we have a link right at the top to get your tickets for tonight's final showing in theaters. And then, of course, after this weekend is done, Lord willing, we'll get feedback as to how well the film did in theaters across the country. With the major events in the Bible being so well attested to, from the creation, of course, the global flood, of course, the fall of Jericho, of course, all the way through to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Then in the middle of all that, we had the Exodus, where we had precious little evidence outside of the scriptures when we're trying to reach people and give them an answer for the hope that is within us. As the New Testament says, faith is the evidence of things not seen. We had precious little evidence for the Exodus, which is such an enormous event that you would think it would leave its footprint, its impression on the pages of history, in the rocks themselves of Egypt. But until 5 years ago, there was very little that we could offer to a skeptic. Now, there is a mountain of evidence that is so exciting. And Tim Mahoney, probably the best man in the entire world to take on the task of searching out that evidence and presenting it to the public. And what a phenomenal job he did with the first film, Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, and how in the world he could outdo himself. So exciting. So tonight, 6:30, that's the time of the one showing. This evening, the last in theaters. And so please, if you possibly can, go not only to help yourself, to encourage yourself, to strengthen your faith, but go to help others. Of course, you can invite a friend, a family member, a coworker, but you also will encourage Tim Mahoney and the whole team there at Thinking Man Films. That's their website, thinkingmanfilms.com. And if it does well in theaters, by definition, then it does better in DVDs and on the streaming services online that it'll get to eventually. So please go tonight, if at all possible. In a few minutes, I'd like to play the audio track for you from the latest video we've put on our YouTube channel. And basically, it's a Gosnell, Kermit Gosnell update. But it's not about Kermit Gosnell. One of our staffers here in the audience, we're playing the video, and he came in a little bit late. He thought it was about that abortionist who was convicted of murder for killing the babies who were aborted but survived, and they came out of their mother's womb alive, and then he killed them. So he's convicted of murder. He's in prison. There's a major motion film about it, which is tremendous. So our staffer thought that this video interviewing three clinic workers, he thought they were working for Gosnell. They were not. This is a completely different abortion mill in a different state. And so we're going to air the audio of these nurses talking about what happens when a baby who was targeted for death, to be killed, when that baby survives the abortion and is delivered alive, what happens then? So we'll air that in a minute. But first, a debrief of our trip to Decatur, Alabama, at Fairview Baptist Church, Pastor Brian McLaughlin. What a tremendous time we had. I had the honor of traveling this time with my wife, Cheryl, our son, Michael. And it began at a local high school with about 35 students in a classroom where I presented our dinosaurs, diamonds, and DNA, the evidence for a young Earth. To these kids, we had an hour and 25 minutes, which meant it was plenty of time to get through these three pieces of evidence, dinosaurs, diamonds, and DNA, and take about a dozen, maybe 15 questions. What a neat opportunity. And from my sense of reading the crowd, which is not hard to do, about a third of the crowd could not care less. Another third was mildly interested, and another third was very interested. And some, like when we had video clips, including a clip of me talking to the world-famous paleontologist who inspired the Jurassic Park novels and was an advisor with Steven Spielberg on the set of all five Jurassic Park films. When I talked to him and offered him finally up to $23,000 to carbon date the dinosaur bone that they found soft tissue in, dinosaur blood, blood vessels, red blood cells, connective tissue, proteins. And I offered him this money to carbon date that bone, and as that audio played, you could almost hear heartbeats in the classroom. I mean, everybody, even the third who couldn't care less, were paying rapt attention. So it was a great time in this high school classroom. Then on Saturday, there was a two-hour luncheon to raise funds for Bible translation into a language in Uganda, Madi. And that translation project, they're currently in the book of Romans. It was $25 a person. There was about 60, 70 people there. I had the honor of speaking to the group. And wow, able to take the Mahdi translation of Romans 1:17, which was exactly on topic with the text of my presentation at the high school and at Fairview Baptist Church. It was just uncanny. And we talked about the need for translation and the fact that we have an alphabet in the first place, which is what the film is about tonight. The skeptics, the atheists, they say that Moses could not have written the first books of the Bible because there was not even an alphabet at the time. And if you're going to write it in Egyptian hieroglyphs, your scroll is going to have to be about a mile long. You can't do it. It's too unworkable, unwieldy. So you need an alphabet. And the atheists, Egyptologists and linguists and historians, archaeologists, they say there was no alphabet in existence at the time of Moses. That's what the film is about tonight. It will send chills down your spine. How awesome it is. And the evidence that God has filled the earth with. So the luncheon was tremendous because we got to talk about the origin of languages and how the world's leading linguists who are atheists like Noam Chomsky and Edward Sapir, how they have acknowledged that Charles Darwin's predictions about the origin of language, they've all been falsified. They're all false. They have not a clue how language could have evolved. It has nothing to do with animal chirps and grunts and barks and all. So then to Fairview Baptist Church, Friday night, what a tremendous time. And then Sunday morning for the main service, the sermon, and a combined Sunday school after the sermon, presenting the evidence. When we develop this presentation, and I say we because it's a team effort, here at Bobinert Live and Real Science Radio, our producers, our graphic designer in Canada, British Columbia, Brad Heima, outside of Vancouver, and then the congregation of Denver Bible Church, because what I did before, 2 weeks before I went to Alabama, I delivered on Sunday morning a rough draft of the presentation and asked the men of the church, all everybody, the moms, I would like input after church. Please come up to me. I'll approach you. I'd like your input on how to improve this. And sure enough, over the next 2 weeks, it became so powerful. And here was our goal. Somebody asked, what is the goal of this presentation? And that's essential, right, to know in advance. So I said, the goal is, now this might sound audacious, but this is the goal. The goal is to create the most powerful young earth presentation that has ever been given in the history of mankind. That's the goal. Now, we may not meet the goal, but that is the goal. If you're going to do it right. And so the title of the presentation, Dinosaurs, Diamonds, and DNA, the evidence for a young earth. Wow. And so with God's help now, the church filmed the presentation. Our video editors are getting that film, that video, and they're evaluating it to see if it's sufficient for us to create one of our RSR resources. We have our Evidence Against the Big Bang video. We have our Global Flood and the Hydroplate Theory. We have our video confronting the theistic evolutionists like those at Pepperdine University in California. And so now, wouldn't it be awesome to have RSR's Dinosaurs, Diamonds, and DNA, the evidence for the young Earth? Boy, that'd be great. So please pray for our team that will be able to pull that off, and we'll have a great resource. Now to the latest video on the Bobinert Live YouTube channel. Real easy to get there. KGov.com, click on YouTube, and you'll be at our channel, and you will see this video after the worst abortion video yet, which is at about 100,000 views. Now this... wow. And it comes from Mark Crutcher, who you heard on this program a week ago. Let's hear the audio track.
On May 13th, 2013, Kermit Gosnell, a Pennsylvania abortion doctor, was convicted for murder in the deaths of several children. In that trial, witnesses testified that these babies survived abortions Gosnell was performing, after which he killed them outside the womb. Although the media, in concert with the American abortion lobby, is portraying this as an isolated situation, the pro-life movement has been aware of similar stories for years, and today, additional examples are beginning to emerge. On May 3, 2013, the following interviews were conducted with three recent employees of an abortion clinic located in a different state. Their real names are used in this production, but the identity of the doctor and his facility are being withheld to keep from compromising a criminal investigation into this matter. At the time this video was released, the abortion clinic in question remained open. Warning: this video contains material that is graphic and disturbing, and it is not suited for all audiences. Discretion is strongly advised.
I was an OR assistant. I was basically, I did a lot of parts of the clinic, and one of my jobs was his right chair assistant. And I really didn't, I never paid attention. I did pay attention, but I didn't know that it was illegal. When he did an abortion, especially a over 20-week abortion, most of the time the fetus would come completely out before he either cut the spinal cord or he introduced one of the instruments into the soft spot of the fetus in order to kill the fetus. And but I wasn't aware. You know, I thought, well, it's an abortion. You know, that's what he does. But I wasn't aware that it was illegal. And on many occasions, we had fetus that he would use the process as far as what is it called, where he would dilate the cervix and then evacuate the uterus. And most of the time we would see him where the fetus would come completely out, and of course the fetus would still be alive because he was still moving, and you could see the stomach breathing. And that's when he would do his he would snip the spine, as they're saying that this doctor did. And of course the soft spot was one of the spots that he would take the one of the forceps, or the what is it called, the dilators, and stick it down the soft spot of the fetus's head.
When you saw this happen?
Oh yes, I think every morning I saw several occasions. If we had 20 something patients, of course maybe 10 or 12 or 13 or 15 patients would be large procedures, and out of those large procedures, I'm pretty sure I was seeing at least 3 to 4 fetus that were completely delivered in some way or another, because sometimes laminaria causes the cervix to get so soft that you don't need a lot of pulling or anything on it. Once you take that package out, 9 times out of 10, that fetus is ready kind of just to flow from inside of the uterus out into,
When you say package, you mean the laminaria?
The laminaria package insertion, yes, right. Sir.
You take that out and the baby's ready to come out?
Yes, sir. As soon as that, or sometimes he would go ahead and bust the water sac, and there you go. You know, you practically had a fetus, in the pan.
So. And you see the baby alive?
Yes, sir.
And him kill that baby outside the womb?
Yes, sir.
And this would be done by jamming some sort of instrument into the
either that or
soft spot,
or twisting the head off the neck, kind of with his own bare hands.
And you saw that happen?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. So he would go through
the stomach as well.
Sometimes he would do what?
He would like force it through the stomach.
The instrument, mm-hmm. Is it Beards?
And like twist it.
Yeah.
And you
another
saw that?
Mm-hmm. Anything that he could get to the fastest. Like she said, the umbilical, he was probably perforating the umbilical cord. I normally saw either the snipping of the spine or the introduction of the instrument in the soft spot of the fetus, normally. Or twisting of the neck.
He would put like his finger?
Yeah, or his finger. He'd take his finger and then
through the throat.
Yeah. You remember that the one that he did, that the baby, that he came, the fetus came out and it was alive. He had thought he had actually killed it already, and he opened up his eyes and grabbed his hand, his finger. Mm-hmm. Remember that one?
No. What happened?
Supposedly they said that it was a botch, and it was a botch abortion. The fetus was still alive. He thought it was dead,
mm-hmm.
and. The fetus opened his eyes and actually
grabbed his finger.
Was able to grab his finger. And the whole procedure, I guess, while he's doing the procedure.
He was getting
ready. After the fetus, of course, he has to massage the abdomen to bring the placenta down, or grab it with the forceps to bring it out.
And this baby was
alive.
Now, huh?
He was alive.
Well, yeah, he's looking at him and grabbing his finger.
Yeah.
Yeah. He thought he had finished with the baby.
He thought it was deceased.
It was a disease already. He was getting ready to put it in the bag.
Did he talk about that?
One of his employees did. That's how I found out.
He doesn't talk about that. He doesn't make any comments about it.
How did he kill that baby, do you know?
We found out about it through another employee. I don't think that was said how he killed it. I'm not sure. That must have been a big abortion, though, I believe. Can't really recall, but I know that he does a lot of huge abortions. A lot of the times we would bring the big fetus that were overage, and we would reopen the bag and just look at it and be like, oh my God, it's so big. You know, we would be amazed how big it was, and we'd be sweating and stuff because it'd take us almost an hour to perform an abortion that big. It's really hard when you only get doing an abortion that big and only dilating with like maybe 13 to 14 laminarias in the cervix. It's kind of hard. Sometimes he couldn't get the fetus out. He would yank piece by piece when they were over the size. And I'm talking about the whole floor dirty. I'm talking about me drenched in blood. We had several occasions that where women would come in and they would actually be going in labor because that overnight insertion, the package, he might have gone a little bit too far. I would put in too many in there, and some women had started to cramp, and sometimes they would get to the clinic and they would make it to the OR room because they're in a line, and you know when they get there, they give them these pills called Cytotec, and they put them in your gums, and it takes it takes about an hour before you get a full effect, and that makes your uterus start contracting. And so a lot of we've seen a lot of cases where women would have to, they felt like they had to push and they had to run to the bathroom and stuff. And on some occasions, we had women that were the fetus were falling into the toilet, or they were or before even getting to the clinic, we had one incident where it was big news, where the fetus was left in the toilet. I don't know if y'all heard of that one. She was at McDonald's. They stopped there in the morning, and the fetus was left in the toilet, and nobody ever found out whose fetus it was, but it was one of his patients. We knew it because we were watching it on the news that day that she was supposed to be in the clinic.
Do you remember that one that she was on her way to the OR, Crystal? And she was walking to her OR, and she had it right there in the hallway.
She had her baby in the hallway?
Yes.
And what happened to that baby?
I wasn't down there when that happened. Were you down there?
He just picked it up with like a pad, one of those...
Chucks.
A chuck.
Uh-huh.
And put it in a trash bag.
On some occasions, of course, he pulled out a lot of breached fetus, and their toes would be moving. You know, you can see the fetus toes moving. And as he would insert the forceps, what are they called? The beards. There's two types. There's the beards, and then there's the sofers. The beards are the ones with the bigger claws, and that's the one he would use to yank the fetus out. And I remember, I have a visual all the time. I always remember this. It's real disturbing to me, where he used to clamp, like push it in. He would hold the fetus by the feet and kind of pull down and insert the claws. And when he would squeeze them, you can see that baby's toes spread open. And I would always say, oh my goodness, you know, when people say that that they don't feel. Well, if they didn't feel, why would their toes, their toes would be out hanging, kind of like in a, what's going on, you know, where am I going? And I remember clearly every time he used to use that instrument. I remember those little toes, you know, opening wide. It was a sad picture. I normally would turn around, kind of just hold and, you know, just turn around until he was finished. And he would do abortions way over 24 weeks. I mean, there's a big difference in a 24-week fetus. And every week from 24 on up, that 1 week is such a big difference. I'm talking about big fetus. I'm talking about being in the OR about an hour trying to do one procedure that big. I'm talking about being really tired after this procedure from where he could not get this fetus out, you know. And it's very overwhelming. We used to look at each other, and sometimes our tears would come out, you know, with the other assistants. Our tears would come out because we would say to ourselves, why? We would always think he's so greedy, you know. And we were not talking about normal price. I'm talking about $4,000, $5,000 for a procedure this big.
As long as the patients had the cash, he was going to do it past the 25 weeks.
Yeah.
Did you ever assist like?
Yes, I did.
You did? Mm-hmm. What kind of experiences did you have?
The same thing she did is the same thing I did. I would tell Deborah all the time, Deborah, I don't want to go in there. I don't want to go in there. And he would tell me, like, you can do it. You can do it. If you feel like you just can't look at it, just turn your face.
He wanted me in the phone room because I've always been pretty good at appointments and, you know, talking to people and convincing them to come to the clinic. I just knew my way, you know, as far as talking to patients, being real good convincing patients to make appointments. And so that's when he threw her in the back office, which was OR, sterilization, you know, things like that. I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, from these large abortions, these botched abortions that he was doing, to hurting the patients on the table to causing some kind of major problem with the woman's, you know, ripping a uterus and not letting the patients know, trying to stitch them back together and send them home with the package of gauze, and then they come back tomorrow so you could pull it out, but never telling the woman, you know, hey, I ripped your cervix. You need to get some kind of, you know, some kind of special, you know, you need to get that looked at, you know. He would never tell the woman.
And if he had a patient that asked a lot of questions, he'll prefer for them to be put to sleep.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Any little comment that you would make as far as if he were on the table, it was his way of making more money, of course, because deep sedation meant dishing out another $200. So if you made, is it going to hurt? I mean, this man would walk out the room and say, Deborah, go talk to her. Tell her she needs to get put to sleep. And normally it was our job to go convince the girl that she had to get put to sleep. And a lot of them raise a lot of hell.
Right.
But they didn't have no choice. They had to do what he said, because guess what? You're going to lose $150. In other words, that was $150 that you did not get back. So a lot of them would either lose the $150 or pay the $200 and go ahead and get it over with.
So other employees besides just Deborah and Crystal knew that these sort of things were going on?
Yeah.
Everybody there.
Everybody knows. It's an open book.
The women that go there have no idea what they're getting themselves into. A lot of the questions have been, does the baby feel? And I think that would make me so mad, because I would say, why would that matter to you if you're coming in here to kill your baby? You know, why ask that question? And of course, she would want to say, yeah, it feels, but that wasn't your job to say that. Your job was to, whatever it took to get that person in the back, you know.
How tragic this is, how painful it is to hear, but also how important. When you look in the Bible and you see the sin of mankind and the severity of it, at first it led to Adam and Eve being kicked out of the Garden of Eden. Then it led to the global flood, the worldwide judgment, because the earth was filled with violence and every thought of man's heart was nothing but evil continuously. Of course, that's a figure of speech, but how wicked mankind is. And then the ultimate picture of how vicious human beings are and how horrific our sin is the picture of the crucifixion. Jesus Christ on the cross is a visual image. There are Christians who are against using graphic images, like when you're trying to teach people about the Holocaust and what the Germans did to the Jews and others. They don't like seeing the graphic pictures. And they say with abortion, don't use the graphic pictures, even though, of course, they have been instrumental in saving the lives of thousands of babies and bringing hundreds, if not thousands, of parents and others to salvation through trusting in Jesus Christ by the personhood advocates, the abolitionists who are at the abortion mills across America. So graphic images and, tragically, the graphic descriptions of what human beings are like, and then abortionists and the abortion industry, the abortion lobby, and all these politicians, be they Republicans or Democrats, who have done everything to continue the slaughter of innocent children, including Republicans filling the federal judiciary with pro-abortion judges.